We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. We're glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. For more than 100 years now, young people have been leaving America's small towns. Our guest for this hour of the show, sociologist Patrick Carr, says that while the numbers here, the demographics aren't quite clear, our understanding of what motivates young people to leave the places where they grew up is not so clear. What we do know, he says, is that their decisions have undeniable consequences for huge sections of the nation. This morning, our guest, Patrick Carr, will talk with us about a book that he co-authored along with his partner and wife, Maria Kefalos. The two of them moved with their family to a small town in Iowa and spent time there, talking with people who lived in the town, talking with people who had grown up there and had moved away, trying to get a handle on why people stay and why people leave, what maybe can be done to try to prevent the loss, this continuing and accelerating loss of small-town America. They have written about this in a book that's recently come out. The title of the book is Hollowing Out the Middle, The Rural Brain Drain and What It Means for America. That's the subtitle. The Beacon Press is the publisher. Our guest, Patrick Carr, is associate professor of sociology at Rutgers University, New Brunswick. His partner, Maria Kefalos, is now associate professor of sociology at St. Joseph's University. The book, as I say, is out now if you'd like to take a look at it. Questions are also certainly welcome for people who want to call in. The local number here, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. If it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free line, 800-222-9455. And we are now taking questions by email. So you email your questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. But either way, really will help us to keep it brief so that way we can get out and get in as many people as possible. Professor Carr, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
I know that you have said that that you are pleased that the book has actually gotten a lot of attention because you felt that this issue was one worthy of attention. But I know that you've also said that you were actually a little surprised that this book has gotten as much attention as it has.
Yeah, I think we have to put these things in context. For an academic, we're not academics. My wife and I, we're not used to people paying that much attention to what we do. So when that happens, we're always a little bit surprised. And I think, more fundamentally and joking aside, because it's been an issue that has been, existed very much below the national radar, the attention that we have got and the conversation that has been started because of the work, has been, pleasantly surprising to us. So, but I think it's a good start.
Yeah. Maybe we can start out and I can ask you to talk a little bit about numbers, because certainly over the last decade, the out-migration from rural areas certainly has been dramatic. And has the pace actually increased?
It has. There are a couple of trends that I think, give you a very concise picture of what's going on. Between 1980 and 2000, about 700 non-metro counties lost 10% or more of their population. And that's mostly young people out-migrating. And then between 2000 and 2005, the more recent figures show that in about almost 800 non-metro counties, there are now more deaths than births. So you have, two trends kind of coming together. One is that the young people have been leaving, and that pace of leaving seems to have accelerated. And then two, you have an aging population where you now have, as I said, more deaths than births. So both of those two, larger demographic trends give you a picture of, the sort of emptying out of these places.
Yeah, and there, I know that you've said that there here is a real possibility that some of the kind of towns like this one, the place in Iowa that you call Ellis, and I'm sure that there are places in Illinois that are very similar, there is the real possibility that we would see these towns simply die.
In large part, yes. I think that's the trend. One of the things we've been very careful to do is to you know, paint the picture in ways that people see this as a continuum. So on one end of things, you have a very healthy, robust small town that has, you know, a fairly diversified population in age structure, has enough kids to keep the local school going, has enough jobs to, you know, keep that sort of local economy fairly strong and healthy. And on the other end, you have a kind of a hollowed-out town where, you know, you have an aged population. There aren't enough kids to keep the local school going. There aren't really any jobs to keep, you know, young and sort of middle-aged people there, or certainly keep them economically viable. And you know, what's happening is that you have, you know, so many towns in between those two poles. But I think over the last 20 or so years, you've had many more towns tending towards the hollowing out phase. And I think if we don't address the problem and come up with sort of ideas that sort of arrest this decline, you'll see many more going towards the hollowing out phase.
Yeah. This, I wonder how it is, maybe you might talk a little bit about how it is that you came to this project. Are you a rural sociologist? Was this something that you were particularly interested in?
Absolutely not. I have to, I'm speaking for my wife, but, you know, I shouldn't speak for her, but I will on this occasion. We really didn't have any expertise in this at all. We're both urban sociologists. We've spent most of our time and done most of our work on cities and, you know, issues in cities. I'm a criminologist. My wife is a cultural sociologist. Mm. And we were hired to do a job by the MacArthur Foundation, basically, which was to sort of investigate what it's like to be a young adult in rural America, in non-metro America, what it's like to kind of grow up and come of age, basically, in a small town. And that's kind of the brief that we had in 2001 when we sort of set out to do our research, and we moved with our family to the small town in 2002 for a while and kind of went all over the country talking to people who had grown up there. And the more we talked to people about being a young adult and sort of the process of coming of age, the more we came to realize that for many young people, in fact, maybe for all young people in small towns, when you come of age, when you turn 18, when you finish high school, you're faced with two basic fundamental questions. First of it, which is, you know, do I stay or do I go? And then secondly, if I go, do I ever come back? And the more we sort of began to think about that, we sort of said, well, this is kind of a larger issue. It's not just about becoming an adult. It's about the future of these small towns. And, you know, it took us a while because we're a little slow in the uptake, but the more we kind of process this and say, well, you know, there's a bigger story here, and that's kind of what we ended up writing about.
Yeah.
So we don't bring a lot of expertise to it, but I think we bring this sort of maybe a perspective of an outsider that maybe some fresh eyes on a situation that, you know, has existed for a long time. We didn't discover it, obviously, but, you know, maybe we have some perspectives that can add to the conversation.
Sure. I'm sure that when people come to your work and hear you talking about it and hear you say something like, as far as young people are concerned, the big questions are, do I stay or do I go? And if I go, do I ever come back? I'm sure some people would say, hasn't that, at least for the last century, been the story of small towns? And how is what's going on today different?
Absolutely. It's a great question. It has always been those have always been the questions. And you know, it's, again, we, you know, we didn't discover this, and this is not something that's new. What is different now is that the game has fundamentally changed for those who stay and for many who return. So, for example, a generation ago, maybe not even a generation ago, a couple of decades ago, many small towns in the Midwest and around the country had a fairly diversified agro-industrial economy where there were, you know, good, sustainable, well-paying jobs for those who stayed and for many who came back. So you had, you know, jobs not only in agriculture but also in industry that were, you know, fairly sustainable, lower middle class jobs that you could raise a family on. Now, the changes in agriculture, the sort of tendency toward the big ag and the sort of larger consolidated farms, the mega farms, so-called, and the sort of, you know, erosion of the sort of manufacturing base all over the country, but especially in the Midwest and in places like Ellis, have meant that there are fewer jobs and that the jobs that are available now are worse paying and have fewer benefits than they did a generation ago. And so you have that sort of constricting opportunity pool for those who stay and many who come back. And that's really what's different now. that, you know, that game has changed for those folks.
In this hour of Focus 580, we're talking with Patrick Carr. He is Associate Professor of Sociology at Rutgers University, New Brunswick. He is the co-author, along with Maria Kefalos, of the recent book, Hollowing Out the Middle, The Rural Brain Drain and What It Means for America. The book is published by the Beacon Press, and it's about some time that they spent in a community, a small town in Iowa that they call Ellis, a small town of 2,000, very typical of a lot of small towns around the Midwest. I'm sure there are places very like it here in Illinois. And they spent some time there talking with people who lived there and also talking with people who grew up there and left to try to get a sense of what was going on in the community, why people stayed, why they went away and didn't come back, and what that has to say about the health of small-town America. And they also had some ideas here about what might be done to maintain and support communities like this so that they don't die out. So the book is out there if you want to take a look at it. Questions are welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free 800-222-9455. Email, it's will-talk@illinois.edu. We have a couple of callers. We'll start out with someone in Mattoon on line four. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David. Another interesting show. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to dovetail as to what the guests were saying about the situation and just share my experience very briefly. And then I did have a very quick question. My family and I are originally from Chicago. About 13 years ago, we moved to a very small eastern Illinois, east central Illinois town, about 6,000, basically living on its laurels. I think at one time it was a big canning facility, and that's completely dried up. And I don't know of anybody who's in their 20s that we've known in the community and family that has stayed. Example would be we have two nieces who went to college, became nurses, and live in Champaign, and a nephew who has a very good job in Naperville, which is just outside of Chicago. So I think the situation is driven almost completely by economics. But my question is, when we moved here from Chicago, we were quite involved, my wife and I, in the community, in the chamber and everything. And we went to the county directors and we said, you know, can you help us? We like the community. We're dying a slow death here. And basically their point was, well, you guys aren't by the interstate. The interstate is the lifeline. Sorry about that. You know, good luck. And, you know, don't forget to write. So I'm just wondering if your guests had any, you know, how much of this is driven by geographics, you know, the interstate, is that the lifeline? And if you're not by the interstate, is it probably too sorry for you? I was wondering if you had any thoughts on that, and I'll go ahead and listen off air. Thanks.
All right. What about that? What transportation infrastructure, do you think that plays a significant role?
I think it plays a role. I think to say that it's the only thing is probably a mistake, because I think that necessarily sidesteps, you know, a larger issue of what are the sort of opportunities that you can build. I mean, the caller is exactly right that people are drawn away by opportunities. But one of the things that we found is that, you know, these small towns existed and thrived pretty well based on having a diversified local economy that, again, as I said, had these sort of sustaining jobs. The question then, is that possible? Is it possible now to reimagine a local economy that could have those kinds of jobs again? And I think it is, because, I mean, I think we have to think about what are some of the growth areas in states. Iowa's the state that, you know, we're most familiar with because we did our research there. And we found that, for example, there are, you know, abundant job opportunities in biotech, in health, in alternative energy, and so on. And the question is then, how do you match up the people who are in these small towns with these opportunities? And how do you reimagine a local economy that could pursue wind energy or solar energy and so on? And I think you can. I think you can do that. And I think we maybe have a national government now that's certainly in tune with these ideas and maybe willing to invest in them. So certainly having an interstate by you will always help you, because, you know, you have those links to the larger infrastructure. But I don't think it's the be-all and end-all.
All right. Let's go to another caller here, Geneva, line one. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. A good topic. Yeah, you know, there's so many reasons out there why small towns are dying away. I came from one, actually, and it was because I moved away from it because of employment. There was things in town, unless you were a farmer or you know, there was like aircraft at the time where I came from. The aircraft industry was the only thing in town that was, you know, basically getting things going. And, you know, the economy went south, and so, and, you know, everybody left and went to other places. I was driving 50 miles one way to work every day, and I got to the point where I was, you know, spending more money on gas and trying to get there than the job was worth. So, you know, that's why I'm out in the Midwest now, not in the West. This whole thing with the economy being the way it is, I think that's going to be a big bubble. I think that's the big thing now for the reason why our economy, or these small towns are dwindling away. I mean, and, you know, I haven't seen anybody come up with any good ideas yet on how to keep these things afloat. My in-laws live in a town in Oregon, outside of Eugene, Oregon, about 50 miles away from there to the southeast, and they're in a town of like maybe 8,000 people. And the only thing they have to rely on is tourism. There's a big ski resort up there, and the business has dropped off quite a bit. My in-laws have business that they're trying to run, and I'm seeing people fold up left and right, small businesses. Now, we have a president that says he's going to try and take care of small business, but I haven't seen it. I've seen more people go out of business this last 6 or 8 months than I've in small towns than I've ever seen in my lifetime, and I'm 53. And I don't see an end to it. Do you guys, you know, I've never heard anybody come up with a solution to the problem.
Yeah. Well, let's turn to the guest, because I do think that you have some ideas, at least. Your argument is that, in fact, you think that in certain ways, the rural areas of the country, towns like the kind of towns that we're talking about, are really positioned to take advantage of some opportunities for new industries, things that we're talking a lot about trying to develop. And I think that you would say, well, that's really the place where they could and should develop.
I think so. I think one of the things, as bad as things are now, and they are terribly bad, and they're terribly bad in places that, you know, had been bad for a while, I think one of the things that we might have been better prepared for the larger sort of economic downturn if we'd sort of paid more attention to small towns, because they had been hurting before the most recent sort of recession. In many ways, they were the kind of canary in the coal mine that we sort of ignored. But be that as it may, as bad as things are now, one of the things to do is to not be Pollyannish about it, but to think of this in terms of an opportunity that, you know, what can you begin to build that, you know, what are the waves of the future? What are the industries that are going to employ people? And what are the sort of things that by their very nature can be decentralized, that don't have to be in a big city or in a big suburb? And, you know, again, you think of, you know, alternative energy as being one of them. You can think of sustainable agriculture as being another. You can think of health and health services as being another. Again, as these places, these rural places empty out, you have an aging economy that has a great need for health services. In Iowa, the state of Iowa, and in several other Midwestern states, over half of all non-metro counties have at least one medically underserved area. Now, that's an area that, you know, again, there is the potential for good, sustaining jobs, that if you train people and retrain some people, that, again, you can take jobs in healthcare as nurses, as you know, medical assistants, dental assistants, and so on. That are, you know, again, these are ways that you can begin to think of ways that you can build these and reinforce these local economies.
Yeah, I think you. I know. I saw a presentation that you gave about this not all that long ago. I think. Am I remembering right that in fact the community where you were was really hurt, was really devastated by the closing of an appliance manufacturing plant that they had, and that they've somehow managed to turn that around, not employing as many people, but they're now using that facility to build wind turbines.
Yeah, I wasn't actually in Newton, Iowa.
Oh, okay.
I was talking about Newton, Iowa, but yeah. Newton is a terrific example. It's a slightly larger town than the ones that we typically talk about, but Newton is, you know, was the Maytag town. And they were completely dependent on the Maytag plant. And what happened was Maytag shut down and moved. So they lost practically half of their jobs in one fell swoop. And, you know, it's a body blow that many towns would have just given up on. And what they did was they said, look, we can begin to sort of reimagine, you know, what can we do with this plant? We have this huge plant. They decided that they would try and build wind turbines there. And, you know, although they haven't re-employed everybody in, you know, that was in the Maytag plant, about half of the workers, they've managed to retrain them and they build wind turbines there now. So that's certainly one example of how, you know, what you can do to improve.
Well, I want to thank the caller. We're getting very close to our midpoint here, and for the benefit of anyone who might have just tuned in, I'd like to introduce again our guest, Patrick Carr. He is Associate Professor of Sociology at Rutgers University, New Brunswick, and he is the co-author, along with Maria Kefalas, who is also his wife, of a book which is titled Hollowing Out the Middle, The Rural Brain Drain and What It Means for America. It's published by the Beacon Press, and it's about a time that moved with their family, moved to Iowa, and spent time living in a town that they call Ellis, a small town, 2,000 people, typical of a lot of small towns, not just in Iowa, but I'm sure around the Midwest, trying to get an understanding of what life was like in the town and to talk with people who grew up there and were still there and find out why, and then also talk with people who grew up there and left and find out why, and to try to get a better understanding about what's going on with small towns and what can be done to support them. That's what we're talking about here. Questions are welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. You may also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. I want to come back to the basic question here of the difference between you look at people and break it down in various groups according to whether they stayed or whether they left, and ask a basic questions about the basic difference between the stayers and the leavers, you know, the people that grew up there, left and didn't come back, and those people who grew up there and stayed. Is there one sort of basic or a couple of basic differences that account for why it is one would stay there and why one would leave and settle someplace else and never come back?
There are definitely fundamentally different pathways that people take and reasons for doing so. One of the things that distinguishes the leavers from the stayers is that many of the leavers, and there are two groups, the larger group are the one we call the achievers, which are people who go on to four-year colleges and universities, who do very well, become professionals, and who by and large don't ever come back. These are the young people who very early on are almost singled out for special attention in many ways. They're mentored, they're carefully cultivated, given all the sort of, you know, particularly given more of the educational resources than many of the other young people in a small town. And to us, this seems to be, you know, a particularly bad allocation of resources more generally. Not that you shouldn't help people who are talented and who want to go on and do things. I think you should. But if you do that to the detriment of other people, where you underinvest in those who stay, and that certainly was the case in Ellis. And it seems to be the case elsewhere because, you know, the kind of response that we've gotten to the book is kind of, well, this is the same story as my town and so on. We've heard that quite a bit. That's, you know, one of the fundamental differences between the achievers, certainly, and the stayers, is that the achievers get a lot of those sort of collective community and educational resources, whereas the stayers do not. Another fundamental difference between the stayers and the achievers is that the stayers view work as a salvation. They begin to work very early on. In fact, in high school, many of them were working 30-plus hours a week while still going to school. And this allows them to become economically independent at a very early age. So they're pulling a paycheck as a 16-year-old that almost a 24-year-old can pull. And there's a great sort of feeling of independence of that. And they have a great and strong belief in their work ethic and that work will save them. But in actual fact, what happens is that, as I said before, those jobs that were there a generation ago aren't there anymore. And they're worse. So they end up pulling the same paycheck at 24 as they did at 16. And then there's a certain feeling among the stayers that we spoke with that work has really kind of betrayed them, that in many ways, you know, they didn't do well in school, they didn't really pay much attention to schooling, and they feel that they're very underprepared for the sort of modern economy that, you know, places a premium on having skills and credentials that you can translate into the jobs that are available now.
One of the things that I find interesting here is that there are some people, and some of them fall into the category that you're just discussing, who go, but then they come back. There are some, and it seems that what happens is that they go away for education, maybe for a short time, and then come back and settle down, and were people that apparently always had planned on doing that. You know, maybe they went to college and then they came back. And then there are those people that all communities like this really want and need, the professional people, the doctors and the dentists and those who maybe could live elsewhere, but they also come back. What it is that about the place that makes people want to come back, and whether that's something that can be cultivated.
Right. The people who return to small towns, there are two groups. The larger group is the one you spoke about and described first, and those we call boomerangs. And these are young people, in our case, and I think in many cases, usually young women who go away for a short period of time and who always really meant to come back. So they go to community college, get an associate's degree. Some of them go to university and find that to be an alienating experience. And you know, they tried it out. It didn't work. They came back. But for most of these guys, there was always the intention of, you know, that they weren't leaving their town with a view to sort of never coming back. And, you know, these are, as I said, primarily young women. They primarily have white or pink-collar occupations. They tend to marry male stayers, settle down early, have their families early, and so on. And the smaller group of returners are the ones that almost every small town in the Midwest and beyond seems to want. And those are, we call the high flyers, and those are the professions that you talked about. So the doctor that comes back, the dentist, the lawyer, the entrepreneur, people who have some kind of professional qualification and who decide to live in small towns. And the bulk of the policy that sort of goes to reinvigorating small towns really centers on these guys, the high flyers. How do you get many of them to come back? And the answer that most states and municipalities come up with is, well, we need to provide incentives for them. So whether it's, you know, building your local infrastructure to be more attractive, so having bike trails or, you know, coffee shops to bring professionals back. The state of Michigan sort of pursued this as a larger policy, a cool cities policy, they called it. Or whether you provide, you know, tuition give backs or tax breaks for graduates who will stay in a state for 5+ years. State of West Virginia, the state of Maine have done that. What we found actually was that despite incentives, young people, the high flyers coming back that we spoke with, do so for very personal reasons. They're not doing it for the money. In fact, if they were doing it for the money, they wouldn't come back. You know, because they say, well, you know, I could have gone to Des Moines or Minneapolis and made so much more money. They do it for personal reasons. So they come back because they want to be near their own family, or they want to raise their family the way they were raised in a small town. So you can't really legislate for these kinds of personal choices that people make. So it's very, very difficult to see, you know, how you can align the policy to sort of bring high flyers back.
So just to underscore that, I think what you've said is, in fact, a lot of these kinds of programs, the efforts that have been made to try to attract these kinds of people, the high flyers, either to bring people back to their community or to get people to settle in that community, actually those programs, they haven't worked very well.
In large part, they haven't. Now, some programs, you know, the jury's still out. So, for example, in Kansas and in certain towns in South Dakota and elsewhere, they have free land programs. So in parts of western Kansas, they've been giving away, you know, 3,000, 4,000 square foot lots to people, you know, and they're hooked up with sewage and so on. You sort of you have to commit to breaking ground within a year and building within 18 months and so on, and to stay in that town for at least 5 years. It's a little early. The lots have all been taken, so that's the take-up has been terrific with respect to that. And the idea is, again, bringing in young couples who are going to have kids to invigorate, in some cases, resuscitate local schools. You know, so it's a little early to sort of say, well, you know, are these guys going to stay after, you know, that 5 or 7 year period that they've committed to? That might work. One of the other things that we thought about, particularly with respect to medical professionals, was that, you know, there is, as I said, a severe need in a lot of places that are medically underserved for medical professionals.
And one of the things we thought about was, well, maybe prospectively, if you can identify young people in high school who, you know, have an interest in a medical field, who will be going on to, you know, medical school or dental school or whatever it is, and sort of say, look, we'll pay half or all of your tuition if you give us 10 years after graduation, if you come back for 10 years and practice in this town. I think that's an investment that would pay off handsomely. And again, for not that much money, you would, you know, guarantee yourself that you would have those key medical personnel in your community.
Yeah, given the cost of medical education, I would think that there would be a significant number of people who would find that a very attractive offer as well.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And again, you know, the idea that, you know, prospectively you sort of say, look, you know, we'll match you up with an internship, see if this is something you're going to like, and if you really want to go on, you know, we'll pay half or all of the bill, and you sign your contract and say you'll come and practice for 10 years. Again, I think, you know, it's just simple things like that can make a huge amount of difference.
Yeah. You talked about the fact that they're among the people who leave. There are these people. These are the people that you, for the purposes of your study, you call the achievers. And these are the people that they leave mostly to go to college. They attend four-year colleges. Most of them leave and they don't come back. And then there's and within the group of leavers, there are some other folks who have ambitions and who want to see the wider world, perhaps don't have the same opportunities, though, as the achievers do, and that these people, most of them, their way out, their ticket out is the military. And you have talked to those people about what it is they hoped to gain, what it is they felt they were promised, and what it is they felt that they got, and actually found out that a lot of them were really disappointed and felt that, in fact, they were promised one thing, but they got something else.
Yeah, in many ways, they bought the pig and the poke. The pathway out that we call the seekers, basically, the young people we call the seekers, you know, is a well-worn path. This is not something, again, that we discovered. You know, small towns have always sent their sons and daughters into the military in very large numbers. In fact, small towns are overrepresented as a group, you know, compared to suburbs or big cities, in the armed forces. And for those young people who are not the achievers, who are not singled out for that kind of special cultivation, who want to go and see the wider world, this really is the only other option for them. And the ones we spoke with, and we spoke with a number of people who had served in the military and had, you know, done their time and come back, or who are currently serving in the military. And what we found was there was this kind of profound disappointment. Not that they didn't enjoy their service, they did. And, you know, never sort of questioned the fact that they should have gone into the military. But for those who had, you know, done their time and come back, they felt that they were really severely underprepared for the kinds of jobs that are in the modern economy, that they really weren't trained for anything. So one of the more glaring instances was we spoke with this young woman who was a naval nurse, and she'd seen action on an aircraft carrier that was supporting the Iraq war and so on. So she'd seen a lot of hands-on experience, but she explained to us if she was to try now and become a nurse in regular civilian life, she would have to start from scratch. She would have to go back to school, that none of the experience, that none of the course that she had done were transferable for college credit for a nursing degree. And that's the kind of, you know, thing that, you know, could easily be fixed. And, you know, I think in many ways it's kind of shameful, really, that, you know, we take advantage of these young people because they, you know, they want to go and see the world and they want to get the experience and they want to get these kinds of qualifications. But they really don't have the kinds of skills and qualifications that they need. And I think that's, you know, as I said, a pretty bad thing.
Yeah. And those, it seems that those are the kind of people for whom, if you could provide the training, the educational opportunities, and then there were jobs, that those people would be probably likely to stay.
Well, absolutely. I think, you know, in many ways, a lot of the military personnel that we spoke with who had, you know, finished their tours of duty had come back to small towns. So, you know, these are the guys that are also a very, you know, key part of the future of these places. And the fact that they're underprepared, you know, is something that could easily be addressed.
We are coming into about our last 15 minutes in this hour of Focus 580, and I'd like to again introduce our guest, Patrick Carr. He's Associate Professor of Sociology at Rutgers University, New Brunswick. He is the co-author, along with Maria Kefalos, who is Associate Professor of Sociology at St. Joseph's University and is also his wife. They're the authors of a book entitled Hollowing Out the Middle. The subtitle is The Rural Brain Drain and What It Means for America. It's published by the Beacon Press. And the two of them moved together to do this research project to a town, a small town of 2,000 in Iowa, a place that they call Ellis, to try to get an idea of what was going on with small towns, why they were dying out, to talk with people who grew up there, and to try to get some understanding of why people stayed in the town and why people left. And that is what the book is about. Questions, of course, are welcome. Again, questions, comments, welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. So that's for local folks. If it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. And email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We do have a question, an email question here who's come in, and maybe I'll get that in here from a listener who wanted to, you first to talk about the, you know, for the rebuilding of the communities, particularly the kind of places that we're talking about, where you see the money coming from. And will banks have to start lending for this to happen, do you think? Or are we going to have to rely on stimulus money that ultimately comes from the government for this?
I think that any recovery has to be built on both. I think the fact that, you know, again, look at the sort of glasses half full in some respects, that the downturn is an opportunity because there is, in our lifetime, probably an unprecedented sort of federal investment in America. And that, you know, there's a lot of money that's being invested because of the stimulus. And that's certainly a place to start. But to sustain any kind of development, I think the banks have to be involved. I worry that, you know, the banks seem to be generally, and I'm not just talking about, you know, for small towns, generally pretty tight with their money right now. I'd like to see that, you know, I'd like to see credit a little bit more loose than it has been. And I'd certainly like to see credit being given to people who are willing to sort of invest in, you know, those growth industries, the industries that are going to be sort of key parts of the recovery. But so I think it's going to be a combination of both. It's an excellent question. But it has to be both for it to be sustainable.
Yeah. Well, again, I want to thank that listener and others' comments. Again, are welcome as we're moving into our last about 10, 12 minutes of the program. One of the things that I know that you're interested in and you have talked about is the how it is that towns like this can take advantage of existing educational infrastructure. And one of the things that we know now is that to be successful in today's economy, people are going to have some kind of post-secondary education. Not necessarily, everybody doesn't need to maybe to go to a four-year university. But, you know, now I think we've seen more and more just how important community colleges are. Enrollment has hugely been up over the last year or so. I think you're really making the argument that that we're missing the boat by not having, let's say, a system that is more integrated, where high schools, four-year universities, community colleges are more connected, they're more working together. And I think particularly you talk about that what could be gained by having a more closer, more cooperative relationship between high schools and the local community college.
Absolutely. I think that that's one of the first places to start. I think, again, we have to think in terms of reimagining local education. The educational system in a small town is one that is focused on these achievers. Mm-hmm. And if you focus, again, all of your resources on the guys most likely to leave and not come back, then, you know, that's money you're essentially, you know, rolling up into a ball and firing out the window. That's probably not a smart thing to do. And I think, you know, again, it's thinking beyond that one group and sort of say, well, what can we do for these other guys, the guys who are most likely to stay, the guys who are most likely to return, and what can we do to equip them with the skills that they need now? So one of the things we think about is, again, using the sort of community college infrastructure that is there and is, you know, extensive and very well served in a lot of, you know, non-metro areas. So, you know, there are programs that do exist in Iowa and in Minnesota and in Missouri and other places that, you know, offer credit for high school students, you know, take a course at a community college. But these are usually only for those who are going to go on to four-year degrees. Now, again, simply just reimagine this and sort of say, well, what can we do for those guys who are not going to go on to four-year degrees? And how then can we give them the kinds of skills that they need for the opportunities in health, for the opportunities in alternative energy, and so on? And I think, you know, again, that's easy to do, but what you have to have, and it's fundamental, as you've said, is you need these bureaucracies that exist independent of each other, don't really talk to each other. You need them to talk to each other and say, look, how can we work together to link the high school with the community college, to link the community colleges with the universities, and so on, and to sort of, again, map those young people onto the opportunities that exist. Because, you know, as I said, there are opportunities, and there just needs to be better coordination to be able to sort of take advantage of them.
Mm-hmm. For just to go back for a second to talk about the achievers, these are the people who would be at the local school. They would be the superstars. They would be the ones that seem to have the most potential. And often they are the ones that leave. They go to college. They get into their careers and they don't come back. Some of those people maybe do end up coming back. And it's because, as you explained, it's because they have connections in the community. They want to come back and be close to family. I guess I wonder, as you talk to those kind of people, though, that is the achievers who leave and don't come back, would you, and if you ask them, under what circumstances would you consider coming back? And is there something that fairly consistently people say that, well, if this was different, or if this could be the case, I might be more likely to come back? Or is it more the case that it's just from one person to the next, it's different?
It's a little bit of both, not to fudge the question, but most of the achievers, as we spoke to them now, in their mid and late 20s, this may change when they're 35 or 40. Maybe that'll be the next project for us to follow up with these guys. Mm-hmm. But for most of them, at the time we spoke with them, they can't see anything that would bring them back. In fact, it's quite the opposite. They spoke fairly poignantly about, you know, that there's something drawing me away, that, you know, that I just don't see it. And the longer they're away and the further they go, sort of either geographically or just, you know, socially from, you know, their roots, the less likely it is for them to return. For some, and a very small number, you know, and again, we did ask this question, they could hypothetically see themselves coming back if there were the kinds of opportunities available for them to sort of realize their, you know, professional goals and ambitions. And, you know, once they say that, they can say, well, but that's not going to happen. So, you know, I think the issue with respect to sort of luring the achievers back, again, in some ways you're sort of throwing good money after bad, because, you know, while some of them will make that decision based on what they personally want for their lives and for their kids' lives, most, once they've gone, really aren't going to come back. So, you know, you're sort of, if you build your policy based on that, then I think it's probably a false assumption.
All right, let's talk with some other listeners here, some callers. Next is Champagne, line one.
Hello.
Yes.
We drive west every summer to Colorado, and as we do, we like to take the small roads through Nebraska and Kansas. And we would come through towns, I'll give you an example, Funk, Nebraska, or Funk, Kansas. There's nothing there. And I just kind of go, why don't we take this community and basically erase it, move all these people to another community, turn it back to prairie or farmland? Why sustain hundreds and hundreds of these towns that are just so tiny? There's nothing there. And what would it take to restore that land to just being open prairie?
Well, Professor Carr, at least there are sort of two questions there. I think that is it possible that we could actually move people Would you want to do that? Could you do that?
This is a great question. I mean, this is the, you know, let nature have at it question. If they're going to die, let them die. And I think certainly there are some places that are so close to almost extinction or being hollowed out that, you know, it's going to be difficult, if not impossible, to change that. Having said that, I think there are many more places that, you know, with the right kinds of sort of ideas and thinking, could be vibrant again. I think the question you have to ask with respect to the forced relocation is of the people themselves in these places is, you know, would you like to move? And I think the answer is probably going to be no, because there's a certain amount of sort of loyalty and pride and great affection that people have for the places that, you know, reared them and have sustained them. And the other sort of larger question that this speaks to is, you know, is this what we want of our country? Do we want a country where most of these places are, you know, on the verge of extinction? And my answer to that question is no, I don't think it's good. I don't think it's healthy. I don't think it's not right for real and symbolic reasons. I think for real reasons, small towns are a large part of what makes America great. I think they're a large part of what contributes to the sort of the vibrancy of the whole, both economically and socially. And I think for symbolic reasons, I think, you know, this is sort of the small Midwestern town is, you know, beyond the sort of sepia-toned image, is, you know, a real symbolic image of what, you know, America is, and, you know, certainly what part of America is. So I think, you know, it would be a shame to lose it when I think you don't have to.
All right. Next to another listener, someone here calling from Kankakee, line 4. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. Your program is characteristically marvelously timely, and I want to thank you for that, along with so many other things WILL does. I'd like to suggest that a part of this whole picture is a principle which sounds almost naive when you articulate it, but over the longest term would be the most intensively practical of anything, and that is to somehow communicate and use the marvelous powers of communication to make people realize that the profit motive, unless it's very, very enlightened, is self-defeating, and that if we could convince enough of this nation, among others, that there are things more important than profit, we could move our economy, hopefully, away from dependence on war, as much as it is right now, toward and apply just the golden rule, which many of the world's great religions all endorse and express in different ways, to issues like you've been discussing this morning, and that this nation has to deal with, and the world, climate change, the environment, and so forth. That's a comment, and if your guest can shed light on how that might be accomplished, I'd praise him even more. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you for the call, Professor Carr.
Well, if I could shed light on that, I think I might retire. That's a very difficult question. You know, how do we, you know, tackle these issues in ways that don't rely solely on, you know, investment, capitalism, whatever else? I'm not sure that I know the answer to that. I mean, I think, you know, one possible answer is to rely on large-scale public investment. And I think that's certainly a part of it, but it can't be all of it. I think part of what has to happen, unfortunately, probably this is not the answer that your listener wants to hear, is that I think, you know, the venture capitalists and the profiteers have to see a way to make money out of, you know, the green economy and out of, you know, sustainable agriculture and out of things that help us arrest climate change. And I think, you know, that needs to happen pretty fast because, you know, I think when these guys see that there's money to be made and that, you know, I think technological change and ideas and innovation will follow fairly quickly from that. And I think, you know, again, part of the future of small towns has to sort of rely on that kind of investment.
We are at, I want to thank the caller, by the way, we are at the point here where we have maybe 2 minutes left. In terms of conclusions, other than some of the things that we have talked about, are there some other ideas that come out of the work that you've done and the time that you spent living in this community that you would want to mention?
You know, again, just to sort of underscore some of the things, you know, equalize your investments across different types of young people. Don't just center all of your sort of collective resources in those most likely to leave and not come back. Reimagine education to sort of link together the different bureaucracies that exist pretty much independent of one another. And in so doing, help map the sort of the young people who are there onto the opportunities that exist. Think of ways that you can invest in small towns that, you know, point your way towards the sort of the future growth areas and the green economy in sustainable agriculture. Again, I think we really do need to rethink how we produce food beyond the sort of mega farm, big ag ideas. And that has to happen also, I think, pretty soon. And, you know, more generally, I think, you know, again, the thing that we're most concerned with now is beginning this conversation. It's just, you know, having the conversation to say, well, what is the state of many of our small towns, and what can we think, what can we do, rather, to sort of arrest the decline that many of them seem to be in.
And on just very quickly, on a personal note, did this experience change you at all, or the way that you think about small town life?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think I have an abiding affection for Ellis and its people. And I think I have a much deeper understanding of the dynamics of small towns, both the good and the bad. And I think, you know, now I'm pretty much a zealot on these issues. I didn't know anything about it before we started, but you know, I'm you know, passionately an advocate for small towns. I really think it would be a shame to lose them.
Our guest in this hour, Patrick Carr, Associate Professor of Sociology at Rutgers University, New Brunswick. He is the co-author, along with Maria Kefalas, his wife. She is Associate Professor of Sociology at St. Joseph's University. Together they have written the book, Hollowing Out the Middle, The Rural Brain Drain and What It Means for America. It's published by the Beacon Press. And Professor Carr, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.